Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, fiscal cliff negotiations ended in a last-minute deal in the Senate and the House. On January 2nd, President Obama signed the American Taxpayer Relief Act of 2012 into law. And this deal makes permanent almost all of the Bush tax cuts. With so much of the debate about the state of the U.S. economy revolving around the debt ceiling, the budget deficit, and the fiscal cliff, there is very little attention on the millions of Americans who are still unemployed. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, over 12 million people cannot find work. And that number is much higher when you look at the number of people who just stopped looking for work. Today's guest, Professor Robert Reich, says politicians should be focused on job creation because the unemployment figures show that we're a very long way from the job growth we need to get out of the pull of the Great Recession. And that means job growth and wage growth should be the central focus of economic policy, not deficit reduction. And yet the conversation we hear from both Republicans and Democrats is focused on the debt ceiling and cutting the deficit. So what will it take to drastically change the conversation? Today's guest, Robert Reich, has been trying to do this for decades. Robert Reich is Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at UC Berkeley. He served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration and has written 13 books, including the bestsellers Aftershock and The Work of Nations. His latest book, Beyond Outrage, is now out in paperback. Professor Reich has also runs a popular website where he regularly writes about economic issues. His latest piece is called The Hoax of Entitlement Reform. And I am here with Robert Reich at the studios of UC Berkeley. Thank you for coming in.
Well, Rose, thank you for coming over.
Yes, it's nice to be here. I always love coming to this campus. So before we started the show, we were just talking about how you have been discussing these issues for the last, what, three decades now?
Oh, it's so depressing. I was telling you that I'm working on a film about widening inequality in America and the fact that wages for the average working person, the median wage, is basically where it was adjusted for inflation three decades ago, even though the economy overall is twice as large as it was. So where did all the money go? Well, it went to the top. But what is so frightening about this film is the producers have found footage of me saying exactly this. That is, we've got to worry about widening inequality. We've got to stop worrying about the budget deficit. We've got to build good jobs and coming up with... I've been saying this for three decades. You know, talk about failure. I mean, this is really awful.
Well, and I can sense this in your columns, because I read your columns regularly, and it seems like you're just really frustrated with what's happening right now.
Well, look, I'm frustrated, but everybody that I talk with, most people who are looking closely at these issues are frustrated, because obviously we do have a long-term deficit out there in the later years, and we eventually have to deal with it. But right now, the issue is jobs. The issue is wages. We've got 12 million people who are unemployed. If you look at the number of people who are underemployed, it's much, much larger. The number of people who are working part-time, who'd rather be working full-time, and the number of people who are too discouraged even to look for work. I mean, we've got a big, big portion of the American economy and the American working class, that is working people, not just what we used to call the working class, who are not really part of the economy. And that has to be our number one objective. And to talk about how cutting spending and raising taxes on the middle class, which is what, you know, the Republicans, I was in debate with a Republican yesterday who said, well, right now, if you want to cut any more of the budget deficit, we've got to look at raising taxes on the middle class and also cutting spending, Medicare and Social Security. Well, look, first of all, what about the bloated military budget? I mean, if you want us to cut spending, start with military and corporate welfare. But the basic essential truth is that we shouldn't really right now be worrying about the budget deficit. We should be worrying about jobs and wages.
So let's talk. You brought up a lot of things. Let's talk about where we are right now with the fiscal cliff bill, because the New York Times had this analysis and they wrote, quote, just a few years ago, the tax deal pushed through Congress, just as the one that was signed by President Obama, would have been a Republican fiscal fantasy, a sweeping bill that locks in virtually all of the Bush-era tax cuts. Now, I just looked at the Center for Budget Priorities website, and they say that about 85% of the Bush tax cuts are now permanent. You were on this week with George Stephanopoulos on Sunday, and George Will, the conservative columnist, said he loves this fiscal bill because almost all of the Bush tax cuts are permanent.
Yes, and if you look at the number of people, the percentage of the population really now enjoying permanent Bush tax cuts that, as you said, were supposed to be temporary when they were put into place in 2001 and 2003, the percentage of the population enjoying it is now more than 99%. That is, the tiniest sliver of the top 1%, the richest 1%, will see a tax increase. But that tax increase is really back to the Clinton rates. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as if we're talking about going back to the highest marginal tax rate under Dwight Eisenhower, which was 91%. And even when you considered all of the deductions and all the tax credits, the super rich in those days were paying about 52-53%. We're nowhere near that. We're talking about, at worst, going back to the Clinton tax rates, and only for the top sliver of Americans. And this is at a time when right now we're about to get into a new debate over raising the debt ceiling, and the Republicans are already saying we've got to cut programs for the poor, education, infrastructure. We've got to cut Social Security. We've got to cut Medicare. We've got to cut everything, except, of course, military.
Military, right. And President Obama just signed the latest $633 billion military bill.
We could be having two discussions right now, Rose, equally frustrating. One discussion is, why are we so obsessed with the deficit when we have so many people unemployed and we have wages that really do need to be increased, and we've got a demand-side problem in this country, and we're never going to get out of the gravitational pull of the Great Recession if we don't put money in people's pockets so that they can turn around and create jobs. And the second level of our discussion could be, well, if we are, and when we do have to really get serious about the budget deficit, why are we talking about programs that people desperately need, safety net programs, public investments, and we're not really talking about major cuts in the most bloated part of the federal budget, which is our military?
Because, as you write in your latest article, census data shows that 49% of Americans live in homes where at least one person is collecting a federal benefit. Food stamps, unemployment insurance, subsidized housing, workers' comp, up from 44% in 2008. So it's going up.
Well, but that's just a temporary blip. That's because of the deep recession.
Right.
I mean, so a lot of conservatives are saying, well, that's why we have to reform entitlements. But that's not really contributing to the long-term deficit. Every time you have a recession, you have increases in the costs of unemployment insurance and some welfare programs and some food stamp programs, obviously because people need it. They are thrown out of work. And that's why the number one objective has got to be to get people back into jobs, restore economic growth, get wages back. And it's not only a humanitarian goal, but it's also it would help our deficit.
So you've been on the inside. You still have close connections, I'm sure, to people in D.C. A lot of people who worked on President Obama's economic team are now back in Berkeley. How do you explain this? How do you explain that under a Democratic president, the majority of the Bush tax cuts are permanent and we got this fiscal cliff deal? Why?
A very good question. I think the Republicans have been more organized, more strategic over the years, starting with the Bush administration. In fact, actually going all the way back to the Reagan administration, there has been more of an infrastructure of strategic political policy planning on the Republican side in terms of not only getting tax cuts, but also shrinking the relative size of government. Now, I don't see not the absolute size. Obviously, government is growing, but our population is growing and our needs are growing, and we're not doing anything about it.
Where's the pushback, though?
Well, the pushback should be there, but I think the progressive side of the ledger, Democrats, have not been sufficiently well organized. There's just one of the shocking things to me when I was a labor secretary in Washington was how silent the Democrats were and the progressive left was. I remember the time that President Clinton was about to sign what I consider to be a very draconian bill getting rid of welfare as we know it. And, you know, welfare was not perfect. Obviously, it had to be reformed. But this bill that he sent, that he signed, actually almost eviscerated welfare. I mean, it was so draconian. It would really put incredible burdens on the poor. It's been subsequently modified a little bit, but it's still basically we have got rid of AFDC, aid for families with dependent children, or aid for dependent children. And I remember that day vividly because there was no protest. I walked back from the White House feeling that we had made a terrible mistake, the president had made a terrible mistake, and there wasn't one single person on Pennsylvania Avenue or around the White House protesting, expressing any outrage. I mean, where is America? I am of the belief, sincerely, that if people understand what's going on, if they understand the priorities that are being set, and they understand them objectively, and they understand the arguments on both sides, that they will be as angry and frustrated as, frankly, I am. But I don't think they're getting the truth. They're not getting the kind of facts that they need, partly because the media has not been doing its, I mean, with all due respect, its role, partly because some of the media, the right-wing part of the media, and I'll be very frank with you, I think Fox News has been a terrible disservice to the public, filling the public's minds with what are absolute lies. There's no other better way of saying it, and nicer way of saying it. And I think that the demagoguery that we're seeing coming primarily from the right has sort of exemplified George Orwell's, I don't know if you remember it, he wrote a book, 1984, about the big lie coming out of the propaganda of the Second World War. If big lies are told over and over and over again, people begin to believe them, unless they are rebutted. For example, the big lie that the rich are job creators. Mm. I mean, that's not true. The job creators are the middle class through spending creates the necessity for businesses to expand and hire, or whose lack of spending actually discourages businesses from expanding or hiring. If you don't have a large, vital middle class with the money in their pockets to spend, and that's one of the problems right now, we don't, then we're not going to have a lot of new hiring. We're not going to have an economy that is growing. In other words, there is a complete consistency with between a buoyant middle class and economic growth and a buoyant economy and a lot of jobs. If you have inequality, if so much of your income and wealth are going to the top, the vast middle class doesn't have the purchasing power to keep the economy going, which is why we are seeing such an anemic recovery right now. But who is talking about widening inequality anymore? I mean, we had a little blip last year with the Occupier movement.
Right.
But since then, not much talk. The major media, almost no recognition that inequality is related to the high unemployment and the very anemic recovery we are still burdened by.
The thing that scares me that doesn't get much attention is the fact that the majority of the new jobs that are being created are low-paying jobs. They pay between $7.50 and $13.50 an hour. And so I'm wondering, what's in store for the future of jobs?
Well, we ought to be talking about that in wages. I mean, what you're saying is exactly the truth. The jobs that we lost after 2007, 2008, the Great Recession, paid better than the 4 million jobs that we've gained since then. So even though we have a huge unemployment problem, we also have a wage problem. And if Americans are finding themselves getting new jobs that pay less than the old jobs, it's not as if we are doing that much better. It's not just jobs, it's also wages, and we've got to be talking about both.
We're speaking with Robert Reich, professor at UC Berkeley. We're both here over at the UC Berkeley campus. He served as Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. You've probably seen him on many of the cable shows and the Sunday shows. He is a former insider and We're going to open the lines. What questions do you have for Robert Reich about where we are right now and where we need to go? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org, and we already have a number of callers on the line. So let's kick it off with Paul in Novato. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Dr. Reich, I was just wondering what your stand was on the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act. That act worked perfectly, it seems, for 70 years. And I heard Dr. Bernanke say that he thought it was not a bad idea that it was removed. And he studied the prohibition, supposedly, for his PhD. So I was wondering what your opinion was. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Paul. I think that we do need to restore the Glass-Steagall Act. The Clinton administration, and again, I think mistakenly, in 1999, got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. It went along with Republicans in Congress and Wall Street wanted to get rid of it. And that opened the way to these giant financial supermarkets. Citigroup under Sandy Weill became much, much larger. Commercial banking and investment banking could be intertwined. And the size of those behemoths on Wall Street meant that they were too big to fail. And that, of course, meant that they had to be bailed out in 2008. Well, they're even bigger today. Mm-hmm. The five biggest banks on Wall Street today are about 20 to 30% larger than they were in 2007, 2008. And they have a larger market share of commercial deposits. So if there was an argument for capping their size and breaking up the big banks and making sure that commercial and investment banking was separated, if there was a good argument for that in 2008, there's an even better argument for it today.
And it was passed in 1933 to separate the two.
Yes, the Glass-Steagall Act was a response to the great crash of 1929. And one of the reasons policymakers understood for that great crash was that commercial banking and investment banking were too intertwined. It was possible for the investment banks to essentially gamble, make bets with people's commercial deposits. And that meant that those banks, when they got into trouble, threatened the entire financial system. And so, wisely, we had the Glass-Steagall Act, we had the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Act of 1934. A lot of regulations went into effect. And many of those regulations, over the years, certainly in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and then in the first decade of this century, those regulations, under the power and pressure of Wall Street, were gradually eviscerated. I mean, you see, what happens is that when you have wealth and power concentrated in few hands, whether we're talking about Wall Street or we're talking about any other industry or we're talking about the billionaires who've contributed or trying to contribute and they did contribute. They made a lot of headway in the past election. When wealth and power are concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, you have a harder time having a democracy that is responsive to average people.
Given the realities in D.C., how would you go about reinstating the Glass-Steagall Act?
I would, as a matter of political reality, I would work with the new House Financial Services Committee, whose chairman is from Dallas, where the Dallas Federal Reserve Board just issued a report saying that the big banks ought to be broken up. He is in favor of small banks. He has been an enemy of some of the big banks. He was very skeptical of the bailout. Sherrod Brown in the Senate is now on the Senate Financial Services Committee. You have Elizabeth Warren now on the Senate Banking Committee. In other words, you've got people on both sides of the aisle who are very suspicious of Wall Street, and they are gaining power. So now may be a good time to think about reintroducing the not only Glass-Steagall, a kind of tougher Glass-Steagall, but also breaking up the bigger banks.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Paul. Let's go next to Robert in Daly City. Hi, Robert.
Hello. Thank you for letting me speak. It's an honor to speak with you, Professor Reich. I've had a question that's been going on for about a year, and specifically around the election. I don't understand how the Postal Service as an institution is not a political issue other than dismembering it. I do understand that, that UPS and FedEx are really for it. I understand that we have the new internet, which is actually affecting first class mail, but in fact the internet commerce is very strongly hinged on there being an existing postal service, a reasonable method of shipping the items that people are purchasing across the country, and is taking a large bite out of those two private companies. But my point is that if we're talking about jobs, why are we not talking about an institution that is viable and employs over 800,000 people, affects over 3 million jobs, and is in economic trouble because of things like a pension for nobody, that the union itself is crying, why are you mandating this pension for billions of dollars that exists for no one?
Well, Robert, if what you were saying is that the Postal Service needs to be preserved rather than gradually devolved to the private sector, I agree with you. I think that a lot of public institutions, and the U.S. Postal Service is and has been a public institution, a lot of public institutions we are turning over to the private sector because we've kind of succumbed to the ideology that the private sector always does it better or best. I mean, look at education. I mean, education, California is probably the worst example there is. 40 years ago, California, in terms of our K-12 educational system and our public higher education system, was the best in the country. And now it is K-12. We are ranked, I think, last time I looked, about 49th out of 50th states. Mm-hmm. You know, thank God for Mississippi. And higher education, I'm privileged to be, I think, in the best public university in the world. But the University of California, even at Berkeley, is succumbing to budget cuts. I mean, what are we doing? You know, as a country, these public institutions, including public infrastructure and public libraries and public parks and public playgrounds and everything else that has the word public in front of it, are critical not only to our well-being, but to the connections across class, the opportunities for young people and for everybody to get ahead, to have a good life. And yet we seem to have been accepting the ideology that we have to privatize everything, that the so-called market can do it better. I don't buy that.
Well, thank you for the call, Robert. We've got time for one more call before we go to break. So let's hear from Ede in Berkeley. Hi, Ede.
Hi, good morning. Professor Raj and Paul Krugman are the only people that really know what is going on. And what were we doing, Professor Rice? We're doing a horrible thing. We're destroying the country. We're destroying the U.S. It is no longer the same. And people have stole all of this money. The Wall Street and their friends should be in prison, and all of the money should fill down back to the people. The whole fiscal cliff business, by the way, is, as I put it in my Facebook all the time, it's fiscal fraud. The whole thing is to go after Social Security, Medicare, other social services. It's just a continuation of the robbery, the highway robbery that these Wall Street people have taken, the American people, and Obama is involved with it. He is not against at all raiding Social Security. He is just going to say, well, the devil made me do it. The other thing I like to say, the only way we can prevent this criminal from going, do what the Egyptians have done. You need millions of people in the street because the American media have totally betrayed us. The American media is really deserves to be called weapon of mass deception because it's what it is, they lie. And you have totally ignorant people on Fox and NBC and MSNBC that the communicators themselves don't know what is going on. So they ask the wrong questions.
Thank you for calling, Ede. We're going to go to break, and I'll ask Robert Reich to respond after the break. He goes on these shows on a regular basis, so maybe you can give us some insights into why they're asking certain questions and why they're not asking others.
I will try.
We are speaking with UC Berkeley professor Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under the Clinton administration, and you can give us a call, and we'll be back right after this.
Rose Aguilar and her guest Robert Reich in just a moment. Every Tuesday, the Your Call team sends out a weekly email newsletter that keeps you up to date on what's coming up on the show and gives you resources to let you learn more and get involved. Subscribe today so you'll know what's coming up and you can submit your questions and comments before the show goes to air. It's free and easy to sign up. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. Yourcallradio.org. We invite you to participate in this morning's program by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email question or comment to feedback at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about the power of conveying historical events through films. There are a number of historical films out right now, like Lincoln, Argo, Zero Dark Thirty. These are receiving widespread attention. How do you sort fact from fiction in historical films? And what are some of your favorites? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line. Feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are spending the hour at UC Berkeley with UC Berkeley Professor Robert Reich. He was Labor Secretary under the Clinton administration. He has written 13 books, including the bestsellers Aftershock and The Work of Nations. His latest, Beyond Outrage, is now out in paperback. He's got a popular website where he regularly writes about economic issues and also explains things in short videos. You can find his latest piece, The Hoax of Entitlement Reform, at yourcallradio.org. You've probably seen him on the cable shows. He was sitting right next to George Will Sunday on George Stephanopoulos' show this week on ABC. So he's in D.C. regularly. He's been on the inside. What questions do you have for Robert Reich about what we're currently facing and where we're going? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So what insights, because you do often talk about the media, what insights can you give us about maybe going on these cable shows and talking to the hosts and, you know, what do they get and what don't they get, do you think?
Well, look, at most of the cable shows are in the business of attracting eyeballs.
Right.
For their sponsors, for their advertisers. And so they want a gladiator contest. I mean, they want people shouting. They want people shouting at each other or shouting in some way. In fact, I remember not all that long ago, I was on a cable show, and the producer came into my earbud at a station break and said, "Be angrier." And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You know, you're being too polite." And I said, I don't want to be angry. That doesn't model good behavior for the rest of the country, even though I disagree with my debating partner." And she said, "Well, the two of you have got to really slug it out, because people are surfing through hundreds of channels, and they'll stop only when they see a good gladiator contest." Well, unfortunately, that's a lot of what's happened to the country as a whole. We are highly partisan. We tend to live in places where we agree with people around us, and we tend to go to the internet and only read things that we agree with, and we tend to listen to shows that we agree with. But that means we're not having a national debate in any real sense. And certainly Congress is not debating. I mean, you've got Republicans and Democrats who don't pay any attention to each other. They just have showdowns. We're suffering from showdown fatigue.
Well, and E talked about people getting onto the streets. President Obama is now in his second term. What kind of pressure do you think actually will work this time around?
Well, I think that people writing and letting their views be known is helpful. It is also helpful if people join with other people and a group, you know, as large as possible, lets their views be known. It is helpful traveling to Washington and making a ruckus. It has been helpful in the past. It is helpful. What's not helpful is people basically falling into cynicism and anger. That's the end of the game. In fact, I think that the regressive forces in America who would like to see us go back to before the New Deal, before the Great Society, before we had any kind of safety nets, they really do want us to fall into this kind of cynicism mm-hmm. about the capacity of government to do anything that's right. Because when we do that, that's the end game.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's go through a few, and then we'll get a response from Professor Robert Reich. Let's hear from Stephen in Mountain View. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, Professor Reich. little that we learn from history, Alexander Hamilton, our first Treasury Secretary, understood the intelligent use of deficit, which actually built the early American economy beautifully. Yet now we're seeing all across Europe austerity as the mantra that is driving the banks and the economies of Europe right now, which may not really lead to the development of new jobs or businesses. How is that going to affect the United States if this mantra persists and drives down the economy of Europe?
Well, Steve, austerity economics, and let's call it that, that's what Europe is adopting, really doesn't work. Greece is a special case. Let's put Greece aside because Greece was patently irresponsible and it fiddled with its books in ways that international creditors finally cottoned onto. But if you look at Spain, if you look at Great Britain, if you look at other countries where they had reasonable deficits, they were deficits that they were capable of handling. But by tackling those deficits first and not dealing with their unemployment problems, the net result was to slow down economic growth, which made the ratio of the debts or the deficits to their economies worse. And that meant less and less revenues from taxpaying citizens. It meant less revenues from businesses because businesses were doing worse. And they are now in what we might call austerity traps. We don't want to go in that direction in the United States, and yet there are pressures mounting for us to do that. Democrats have a lot of deficit hawks. I have crossed swords with them for years. Republicans have both deficit hawks, but they also have people who just want to shrink the size of the government by any means. They're not so much interested in, they say they're interested in the deficit, but they really are interested in shrinking government. The other point you made, Steve, is also valid, but it's different from the point I just made. And that is that since Alexander Hamilton's time, we've also understood the importance of public investments in roads, bridges, infrastructure overall, in education. Those investments really need to be treated as different kinds of expenditures. It's wise to borrow, to invest, if the return on those investments is larger than the cost of the borrowing. And unfortunately, we're not following that principle. And that's a principle we did follow for years in this country, through the 50s and 60s especially.
How do you think austerity is going to affect the U.S. in the years to come? Because we are already seeing massive budget cuts across the board.
Well, it's going to continue to, at best, result in a very slow economic recovery. At worst, it will plunge us back into recession. Mm. Look, the worst example of austerity out of control was the fiscal cliff agreement, because I'm talking about the original sequestration agreement that led to the fiscal cliff, because that would have led to massive tax increases and spending cuts so quickly, so suddenly, that the economy would have been plunged into recession, as even the Congressional Budget Office understood. So we ended up going over the fiscal cliff for about a day and coming up with some tax increases, little tax increases on the very wealthy, which were reasonable. But now we face, once again, within 2 months, the same problems of sequestration, major cuts in spending, and also, on top of that, a debt ceiling fight that's going to arm and I guess mostly Republicans here, with the power to even get more spending cuts at a time when we ought to be doing the opposite. I mean, we need more spending. We need tax cuts on average working people. Instead, we continue to cut public spending, and we are actually increasing taxes. If you look at the Social Security payroll tax increase, payroll taxes are now up from 4.2% to 6.2%.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Steve. Let's go next to Karen in Berkeley. Hi, Karen.
Hello. First of all, I'd really like to thank you so much for your activism. I really follow your work closely, Paul Krugman's writings. And you responded to this a little bit earlier, but I want to know what busy people, parents who work full-time, can do with their outrage. I'm outraged by all these policies that reduce mobility and opportunity and increase the income gap between rich and poor. But, you know, I don't have time to demonstrate and go to D.C. I can write emails to my Democratic representatives here in California, but I don't see that really changing that much. I mean, am I misinformed? I mean, what do people like me do? I mean, I can, you know, I'm part of Move On, but I'm just curious if you have some suggestions for ways that we can express our outrage that can be more effective when most of us don't have time to go and demonstrate. We have young kids or whatever.
Yeah. Well, Karen, one thing you can do, I'm sure you have friends or relatives in red, so-called red states. I would correspond with them. I would get them on the internet, on the phone, and fire them up, because their representatives, their members of Congress, their senators really do need to hear from people who understand the facts, understand the truth. Another thing you can do is join with others. There is, there's no substitute. What you say for the truth, that you just don't have time. But many people who say that they don't have time, it turns out that they do spend a lot of time on the internet or watching television or watching movies. Most of us who are very crimped for time actually can squeeze out a little bit more time if it's necessary, particularly with regard to political activism. And I worry, frankly, that many of us have just given up on political activism. By activism, I mean not just joining Move On or an organization that I'm chairman of that I feel very strongly about, Common Cause, which is dedicated to getting big money out of politics, not just joining and financing and sending in a contribution, but I mean meeting with others, like-minded people, face-to-face, and become part of a national movement that politicians cannot ignore.
All right, thank you. We have a related question about Occupy from Brian in Emeryville. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Reich, for all your activism. I, too, follow your work, and I'm very appreciative. I just wanted to say, you commented about Occupy, and I wanted to say that it's disconcerting, to say the least, that President Obama, now that he's been reelected, is talking about austerity. In other words, he's giving credence to the Republican notion that we need to start trying to balance the budget during the recession, which is a fatuous idea, as you've stated so eloquently. However, one good thing about electing Obama, in my opinion, is that if he pursues this austerity course, which it appears he will, I think this is going to give rise to Occupy returning, because essentially what we have here when it comes to economic prescriptions are two parties of the same. They're basically, we have two Republican parties. And I don't think people are going to stand for that. I think we're going to see a rise in the Occupy movement because we've elected Obama, and people have nowhere to turn when they realize his austerity program is what we're going to be facing. So I'd like to get your take on the idea that Obama equals reinvigorated Occupy.
Well, I don't buy into the notion of moral equivalency between the two parties. I really think that had we elected Mitt Romney, given my values, what I stand for, we would be in much, much worse shape than we are with President Obama. I think he's a far superior president. But I take your point. I mean, if we're not dealing with the core problems in this country of stagnant wages, widening inequality, a middle class that is eroding, all the people who want to get into the middle class, the poor suffering. We haven't even talked yet in this program about the increase in poverty. Right. 22% of our nation's children are now in poverty, as we've defined it. Unless we deal with these things, we are going to have more, more of a social anger and outpouring. What worries me, though, is that anger and social outpouring of anger can take not just populist or progressive form. It also historically has and can take a very reactionary form. It can take the form of blaming immigrants or blaming the poor or blaming foreigners or blaming whoever you want to blame. The demagogues are ready, and they've shown themselves ready. You look at what's happening to the far right groups that are growing in France, in Europe, in general. I am disappointed that the Occupy movement has not yet, and may never yet, given its the way it's now constituted, become a political force, because it didn't seem the Occupy groups that I talked with and many of the putative leaders of the Occupy movement didn't seem interested in getting their hands dirty in the real work of politics. They seemed so cynical about politics that they didn't want to have anything to do with it. And it seems to me that that is wrong, that the only way we change things in America is understand that politics is the applied form of democracy. And if we give up on democracy, we give up on everything.
What about the response to Occupy? Because we have a question from Catherine at UC Berkeley about how Berkeley and other campuses, especially Davis, was shut down so brutally. I mean, you had heads bashed in, the Iraq veteran was shot. What about that and the response by governments?
Well, it was outrageous. I mean, at the same time, in the wake of Citizens United against the Fair Election Commission, that is that Supreme Court case that said that corporations are people and corporations have the right to, under the First Amendment, to spend any amount on politics, you had a crackdown on people really utilizing their First Amendment right to assemble. And that, to me, justified more of an outrage in response. I think it was, I think that the Occupy movement could have been fueled to a greater degree by those attempts by authorities to shut it down if the Occupy movement had a political strategy, if it had a specific set of tactics to move into the political realm. And I think that the problem, as I understand, and it's easy to say as a Monday morning quarterback because it was a year ago, the problem is that once you took away the tents and took away the Occupy places, the movement didn't have a structure underneath it to keep itself going.
We're speaking with UC Berkeley professor Robert Reich, who served as labor secretary in the Clinton administration, author of 13 books. He has a popular website where he regularly writes about these issues. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. We've got just about 10 minutes left, and we've got a lot of calls and emails, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm seeing a theme in some of our emails about a real left movement in this country, and the fact that we really don't have one when you look in Washington. The Socialist Worker had a really good op-ed about President Obama and where we're at, and they quoted conservative Bruce Bartlett, who served in the White House under George Bush Sr. He said, quote, "The nation no longer has a party of the left, but one of the center-right that is akin to what were liberal Republicans in the past." And President Obama, in a post-election interview with Univision, said, quote, "The truth of the matter is that my policies are so mainstream that if I had set the same policies that I had back in the 80s, I would be considered a moderate Republican."
Exactly.
End quote.
Exactly. I think, in fact, I'm old enough to remember the Rockefeller Republicans, the moderate Republicans, liberal Republicans, Jacob Javits, who was senator from New York. Well, I think that Obama fits into that tradition pretty well. He would have been considered a moderate or liberal Republican. What has happened to the progressive left in the Democratic Party? What has happened to, as Paul Wellstone, Senator Paul Wellstone, the late Paul Wellstone, the late great Paul Wellstone used to call the Democratic side of the Democratic Party? It has, I think, succumbed to a degree of cynicism. That's part of it. Part of it also, quite frankly, is that Republicans and conservatives attract a certain kind of authoritarian personality, willing to take direction and willing to be very disciplined. And Democrats and the left tend to attract very anti-authoritarian personalities who don't want to take direction, don't want to listen, don't want to do what they're told. And that's very good. I'm glad for that in one respect. But it does make it much harder to organize.
And for people outside of Washington, how does that affect activists and people who care about these issues?
It means that people outside of Washington have got to, if they're concerned about these issues, if they are, and I hate to put a label on people and say progressives or liberals, because we're talking about, honestly, no moral equivalence. We're talking about the truth. I mean, I want to make sure that we have a country that is working for all of us, that we have an economy that is working for everyone, that if we have a democracy that is not dominated by a few extremely wealthy corporations and individuals and Wall Street. So this should not be a left versus right issue. The question is, how do we empower people who don't have the power? How do we make sure that the working class and the middle class are once again invigorated to the degree that they need to be politically? And I think that that requires I won't say a third party, but it does require a force, at least in the Democratic Party, at least as powerful, hopefully more powerful than the Tea Party movement.
Well, you brought up poverty earlier, and I just wanted to get in this question about poverty from Mark, who runs a Facebook page about austerity in Indian country. What strategies should poor communities think about to mitigate the worst of austerity, because they're hit the hardest?
They are hit the hardest. Unemployment is hitting people in poor communities much harder than everybody else. That's one reason why when you have politics dominated by the very rich and wealthy and privileged and big corporations, they don't even see that we have a poverty problem. They don't even come across the impoverished. I think the working class in America needs to form an alliance, a very strong alliance with the poor. What's left of labor unions have got to form a very strong alliance with the poor. The SEIU and other labor unions that cater to workers who are in the hospitality industry, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital workers, people who are getting paid minimum wage, they have got to join ranks. That's the only way in this country we form a backbone, as we used to have, of organizations capable of negotiating and demanding their fair share.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Mark. And we've got time for a few more callers. And before we end, I really also want to get your solutions, what you would do to improve things. Because, you know, we tend to kind of talk about what we don't like, and we can do that. We do that a lot. But also just what are the solutions? So something to think about while we take some calls. Let's hear from William.
I've been thinking about it for 30 years.
I know, three decades. I know. William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. I find myself saddened to find that I disagree with Mr. Reich, Professor Reich. And the reason is this. Just because austerity is a bad idea does not mean that the opposite of austerity will solve a problem. The fact of the matter is, and I see it as analogous to kind of a gravity, that gravity just is a force that's there. People in other countries, many other countries, are working for one-third or one-half of what, at the present time, American workers receive for the same kind of work. I would ask Mr. Reich, is it not a rule of economics that people will buy the product that is less expensive? And if that is so, then how can anyone deny that Marx's concept that where one worker isn't free, no one is free? How can one imagine that wages in the United States can ever, in a real sense, increase when other people in other nations in a world economy very different than the 1930s are producing the same products for one half the price of what American workers are producing the same products for?
Well, William, you raise an important point. The fact of the matter is, though, that global trade accounts for about 18% of the United States economy, which leaves the majority of our economy. And what we spend most on are things that other Americans produce, mostly in the service sector. It doesn't mean, however, that we are condemned to low-wage service jobs. With a proper education system, with a proper retraining system, with investments in infrastructure, we can get those wages back to what they should be. In fact, for the first three decades after the Second World War, our productivity improvements in this country tracked our wage improvements. Those were years when we had strong unions, for example. So I would say a combination of investing in education and training and infrastructure, and also making sure that, whether we call them unions or something else, that working people have the bargaining leverage to get a fair share of the output, the profits of our economy, those are critically important. Look at Germany, for example. Germany and German workers are facing exactly the same global pressures we are, and yet the typical German wage is higher than our wage. And the people in the top 1% in Germany, instead of raking in over 20% of total income, as they are here, the top 1% in Germany is raking in about 11% of total income. Why is that? Because Germany is investing substantially in education and job training, and Germany also still has very strong unions.
And alternative energy.
That's right.
Right.
Alternative energy as well.
All right. Thank you, William. And we have time for one more call. Stephen Palo Alto, we've got just about 30 seconds. Hi.
It's very difficult to disagree with what Professor Reich has been arguing over the last several years. One of the terms that has come up several times in his discussion today is his admonition that we don't fall prey to cynicism. And it's very, very difficult for somebody like me who watched his performance as Labor Secretary under Bill Clinton, serving in an administration that helped really represented the incorporation of the Democratic Party. And reading his book, Lock in the Cabinet, the only individual who comes under withering criticism is Lane Kirkland and the AFL-CIO for wanting to hold on to jobs that rightly he insisted would be lost to NAFTA. It's very, very difficult to not be cynical when we hear Mr. Reich now espousing all of the ideologically correct or appropriate phrases. When he was in power, say, unlike Francis Perkins, he was, I hate to say this, completely ineffectual in protecting the rights that he wants to see all Americans possess today.
Well, you may be right. I tried to be as effectual as I could in terms of raising the minimum wage and implementing the Family Medical Leave Act and making sure that all of the international trade agreements we had as strong labor and environmental protections as possible. But looking back on it, I don't think I was very effectual. And I think that that was partly for, you know, because I didn't know enough. I was not angry enough. I was not animated enough. But partly also for some of the reasons we've talked about in this broadcast, that we didn't have, and we still don't have, a progressive left that is powerful enough to push government. You know, nobody. We can have anybody in government. We can have, as Franklin D. Roosevelt once said, we can have very good people in government. But unless people outside government are willing to push the people who are in government to do the right thing, the right thing isn't going to happen. FDR said famously, I want to do what is right, but you must make me. When a voter said to him, I would like to vote for you in the election of 1936. You must make me. That's the issue. We must make people in Washington do the right thing.
Robert Reich is professor here at UC Berkeley, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, author of 13 books. You can find more about his work at yourcallradio.org. Professor Reich, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you, and thank you for your many calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What is the power of conveying historical events through films? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about movies as a tool for looking at history. Recent historical films like Lincoln, Argo, and Zero Dark Thirty are receiving widespread attention. But how do you sort fact from fiction in historical films? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What have you learned about history through watching movies? And what are some of your favorite historical films? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you.